There's still some seats at the front. And at the front, at the side here, some places. Okay, good. You all settle down, ready? Everyone turned off their phones. Sitting comfortably. So, I'm Pandit Bhikkhu, and I live in Thailand, and we have a small group, not as good as yours. I have aspirations to be the Buddhist Fellowship of Bangkok, but we're not quite there yet. We have a small group in Bangkok, and I kind of run that. There are no English-speaking Dharma groups, clubs, or events in Bangkok except for things that I arrange. I'm the only one there. And you'd think Bangkok would be the center, the hub. Thailand likes to be the hub of everything, you know. They like to be the hub of business and the hub of tourism and all the rest of it. But it's not the hub of Buddhism in Bangkok. It's quite interesting. We're the wild frontier. I'm one of the few monks that's willing to get out there into the difficult frontier of city life in Bangkok. All the forest monks, they come and they look around. No way, we're off to the forest. So I'm out there really on the frontier trying to promote Buddhism for the expat communities or the English-speaking community in Bangkok. And that isn't very easy. That's tricky. We do everything for free. I have to find buildings. I have to use free websites and make posters and walk around myself. And I do everything really myself. So you're quite lucky. In fact, you're very lucky to have this really strong group and organization here in Singapore. It's really quite a privilege that you are able to have these facilities and this group and this mutual support and sharing of responsibilities. So I would encourage you to keep supporting and keep appreciating the Buddhist Fellowship. We're going to talk today then. I'm going to talk about mindfulness, and it's one of the usual stories. I'm sure if you've been around Buddhism for very long, you know the word mindfulness, you know what it is. But Dharma is something that's very simple. And the trouble with human beings is we don't like simple stuff. We like complicated stuff. And you don't feel like you've progressed unless you've added to your knowledge. And this is what happened at school. Your school teaches you to learn something new and take a new exam, and then you've got the certificate. And you can line the certificates up on your wall. And this is me. I'm bigger and better than I was before, and I've got more and more. And with mindfulness, it's just the same thing over and over again. We keep coming back to this thing that's very simple and very ordinary. And our job as monks is just to take you to that. So that's the purpose of doing the Dharma talk. It's not really to teach something new, something that you don't know. It's to remind you of something that you do know, remind you of some quality that you already have in yourself. Otherwise, I could teach you Abhidhamma. I could put up lists of the 42 different kinds of this and the 52 Jhedasika, actually 50 Jhedasika and all the rest of it, all these fabulous minds, and get you to recite it and memorize it, and then you go away, you feel, yeah, I know the Abhidhamma. And trouble is, you're still suffering. Probably more than you were before you came. You're probably quite relaxed when you came. Now you're trying to remember all these different mind states. And then something happens and you're like, well, is this desire or is this suffering or is this not desire? If somebody annoys you and you want to get rid of them, is that desire or is that hatred? Lopa or is it dosa? Which one is it? Is it desire to get rid of something or is that hatred to get rid of something? It gets a little confusing. And you learn too many teachings, and it can get a little confusing. I would recommend that people learn as much as you can. It's good. nice. It's good to study the suttas and come back to the original teachings. But at the end of the day, what all monks, our job is to simply take you back to an experience that you all already have, that's so simple and clear that for the most part people overlook it. Now, there's a curious thing with humanity, that if something isn't pointed out to you, and if you don't have a word for it, you tend not to know that it's there. If we don't have a name for something, we tend to be completely oblivious of it. And even if we do have a name for something, unless people talk about it, we tend not to notice. There's always that famous example of the Eskimos and the ice, and they have 20 different words for ice. And some kind of ice you can cut and some you can't. Some you can build igloos with and some you can't. Some make good snowballs and some don't. And so they learn to distinguish between these different kinds of ice. And for a normal person, we don't care. It's just cold. That's all we care about. Cold feet. So if something's important to you, you look at it, you talk about it, you analyze it, and remind yourselves of it. Now, this quality of mindfulness is a little bit like that. You all have it. It's nothing new. But if you don't talk about it, if you don't come to talks about it, if you don't deliberately sit down to foster it and generate it, then it's going to slip out of your awareness, out of your attention. It's a little bit like things like, what's this post-traumatic stress that many soldiers have when they come back from fighting? And in the First World War and Second World War, we hadn't named it. We hadn't said post-traumatic stress, so nobody had it. Now that we've thought of a name for it, suddenly all these people have post-traumatic stress, you see. And that happens with a lot of things. Antidepressants that people are taking. Before we had antidepressants, you were just sent home. Go and stay with your family and rest up. Now we have antidepressants. Well, you're a depressant, you can have these antidepressants, and now I've cured you. And of course, you still haven't made any progress. When we have a name for something, when we talk about it, it becomes more important and it becomes more visible to you. So this is why our job as monks is just to remind you of this quality of mindfulness that you already have inside you. It's nothing new. I wish I could teach you something new, but this is something that you already experience from time to time. The trouble is, your teachers, your parents, when you're younger, they never pointed out to you that there is this sense of simply being, without being anyone, without being anything. They never teach you that. They never teach you to be aware of it. And so it starts to slip out of your consciousness, and you spend most of the time worrying about thinking about different things. I like to sit in cities. I don't like countryside very much, and I don't like trees and things like that. And trees are okay if I'm looking at them through my window, then I don't mind countryside. But I like cities and I like people. And I like to sit in train stations and bus stations and places like that and just watch the people going by. And you look at the faces of the people going by. And the faces of people are going like, all the time. And nobody notices. Do you know why you never notice this? It's because you're one of them. You're also sitting there going, what about, like this. Stop and look around at the faces at you, and you just see, often you see people like making gestures like, and you're like, boy, her husband's really going to get told off when she gets home. And, some man who's counting stuff on his fingers, and you're like, I look around at Thais, and there's the Thais walking past, and I wonder, what are they thinking about? And in Thailand, they're probably thinking about food. You go to England, they're probably thinking about football. You come to Singapore, and they're probably thinking about money. All the time we're caught up in these activities. When you're caught up in an activity, you're not being mindful. This quality of mindful, or just being aware, this lies in a different direction. It's not exchanging one thought for another thought. It's coming back and noticing a fundamentally different quality, a quality of awareness. And this quality is always with you. It's always there. There's nothing special about it. Even you don't have it in greater or lesser quantities. You simply notice it or you don't notice it. It's so it becomes a way of when we introduce the concept, then it becomes a way of dividing your experience up. This is being mindful and this isn't being mindful. And we like to have structures by which we divide the world up. These structures are ways that we can relate to the world. For example, there are three kinds of people in this world: those who can do maths and those who can't. Usually about 50% of people get that, and 50% of people are like, what? So we use these structures to interpret the world, and really what we see in the world around us depends upon our thoughts and our concepts that we hold close to us. So we're trying to generate or remind ourselves of this quality of mindfulness. So this becomes part of the way in which we interpret the world. You start to see times when you're mindful and times when you are not being mindful. Now I want to go back a little bit, reverse the path and go back to the beginning of Buddhism a little bit and what it was all about. The Aryan people, who were most likely Russians, or Kazakhstanis, or from Georgia, this kind of area, the central steppes of Russia, had at some point in the past, they discovered enlightenment, and they'd taken this story or this word about enlightenment and spread it around the world. And we find it appearing in many different areas. We find it in the Celtic tales, find it in certain areas of Roman and Greek mythology. The Aryan people had a spread and had a huge influence across the world. One of the lines of the Aryan, and Aryan, this is long before, you know, like Nazis took over the word Aryan. One of the places they took this idea of enlightenment to was India. And this is how the Buddha got the idea, or got the knowledge of enlightenment. And at that time it was called the Amata, or the deathless. Something that is deathless, something that is immortal. So these ancient stories that talk about immortality, they're not really talking about making this body last forever, which would be a nightmare, of course. But finding that aspect of yourself that is immortal, that doesn't change, doesn't die, isn't born, doesn't die, doesn't change, doesn't get old, isn't here, isn't there, isn't refined, isn't beautiful, isn't ugly. It's what we call unconditioned. And this was the deathless, and the story of the deathless had spread to India, and yet the mechanism, the way to attain to it, had been lost. Now, a little controversial, not controversial, but one hypothesis that we have. Those of you who know Buddhist history, the Buddha, we know at the age of 16, he entered into an archery competition and he got married. The next thing we know about the Buddha's life is he's 29 and he leaves his wife and his newborn baby to go off and seek enlightenment. What happened in the intervening period? Okay. One theory is, in those days, when you would study the Vedas to be a Brahmin, and he was of Brahmin blood, you would go off, you would leave your home and your family for 12 years, and you would do a 12-year course, and you would study the Vedas. At those times, the Vedas were not the Vedas that we have today, but really were the remnants of these ancient stories that had come from the Aryan people that talked about the Amata, the deathless. But of course they're not enlightened anymore. They don't know how to attain to this Amata. They simply recite it and memorize it. So it's highly likely that the Buddha went off and he did this course. This is why there are 12, 13 missing years from the Buddha's history. This is also why he had no babies. Did you think about that? He gets married to this beautiful young girl at 16, but no babies till he's 29. So what happened there? So we consider it quite likely that he'd actually gone off, left the home and family, and done his 12-year study of the Vedas. And this is why in the Buddhist suttas, we find that he actually knows a lot about the Brahmins and the way that the Brahmins thought, and he was able to argue with them, interact with them, and teach them. So he had the knowledge of the Amata, and he comes back, he has a baby with his wife, and he realizes at this point, he spent 12 years learning about something, and still doesn't know what it is. Still doesn't know what the deathless is. So then he leaves, and he goes off, and he tries the other spiritual tradition of the time, which was the Samana tradition. Now, the Samana tradition had come from the Indus Valley civilization some 5,000 years before the present day, 2,500 years before the Buddha's day. And the Indus Valley civilization worshipped animals, and they would go off into the forest and emulate animals. And they considered this a holy pursuit. So, and this is actually where the Minotaur comes from, if you're interested. Crete was also closely related to the civilization on the Indus Valley, which we know because they had the same sewage system. And that's one of the few things that remain of these civilizations. They had a very fabulous stone-built sewage system that still remains today. So the Cretes had this Minotaur. They worshipped these half-man, half-beast entities. So the Indus Valley people, they also had the same thing. They would somehow the amalgamation between a man and an animal was something to be holy and attained, and people would leave and go off into the forest and try to do this and emulate animals in various ways. Sometimes they would go naked, or they would walk around on all fours, or they would eat their food only with their mouth and not with their hands. Well, everybody eats food with the mouth, but you know what I mean. They wouldn't pick the food up. And this was the other tradition, but they didn't have the idea of enlightenment. But the Buddha went off and he tried this anyway, as the other spiritual tradition that was available to him at the time. That was the tradition, in fact, where the saffron robes come from. The idea of wearing rag robes. You collect rags, you bleach them, stitch them together, and then you dye them with the fruit of the jackfruit tree, and that is where you get monks' robes from. They would also cut off their hair as a symbol of their renunciation, so people knew this was a forest renunciate guy, you leave him alone and let him get on with his business. The Buddha tried this tradition, he found that also didn't work. And so this was when he came underneath the Bodhi tree and started to practice by himself. He tried all these ascetic practices. They don't also take him to this deathless. He sits under the Bodhi tree and he makes the determination that I am not going to get up from this seat, even if my bones crumble and my blood turns to dust. I will not get up from my seat until I attain enlightenment. I was really inspired by this. And this was in Amravati in England, Ajahn Sumedho's temple. And so we were doing an all-night sitting. So I will not move from this spot until I have attained, if not enlightenment, something. Okay, I hedged my bets a little bit. And all night I'm going to sit here and I'm going to strive for enlightenment. And by the third hour I was just bursting for the bathroom. And I'd made this resolution. And half my time was spent in my mind, should I go, should I not go, does that count, does that not count? Would the Buddha have got up from his seat on the night of enlightenment? Maybe we'd have no Buddhism if am I just being weak, weak-willed and weak-bladdered maybe? Well, I did get up, and that's probably why I'm not enlightened yet. So, after sitting under the Bodhi tree, then, he comes across enlightenment, and the first thing he says is, I have discovered the Amata. Now, he's not making this word up. This word was already known to him. He knew what he was already seeking, something that doesn't die, something that doesn't change, some aspect of his experience. Okay. So, this aspect of the experience, he went on, now we call it the unconditioned. We also call it the Amata, the deathless, but generally we call it the unconditioned, asankata dhamma. Something that has no conditions. It doesn't it's not born, it doesn't die, it doesn't change, it doesn't cease, it isn't big, it isn't small, it isn't coarse, it isn't refined, it isn't here, it isn't there, it isn't in between. So it's nothing, really. I mean, now there's a trick, there's a catch to this. If this thing called enlightenment is really, you can't create it, you can't destroy it, what that means is it must already be there. That's one part of the concept. It's not something that you can create, therefore it must already be there. So in Mahayana Buddhism, they like to say, you're already enlightened. Which is true, is what Ajahn Chah called true, but, what do you say, true but not real, real but not true. That, yes, that quality must already be there, but the fact that you don't know it, you haven't touched it, it means that you're unenlightened. So sometimes in Mahayana, there was a friend of mine, Pakchok Rinpoche, if you know him, and he's a fun character, a nice character, and so I like to argue with him. And he said, in Theravada, you're not enlightened, and you're going to have to go through 1,000 lifetimes of practice to get enlightened. But in Mahayana, you're already enlightened. And so I thought, great, rub my hands. Now we've got a really good argument brewing. One point is, in Theravada, you don't have to go through thousands of lifetimes to get enlightened. You can get enlightened at any instant. When the Buddha taught Dhamma, the people were getting enlightened there and then, not going through lifetimes. If you want to be a Buddha, then you have to go through lifetimes of practice to be, so that when you become enlightened, you have the necessary charisma and qualities to be fully enlightened Buddha and teach millions of people. So Mahayana Buddhism, because they take the Bodhisattva vow, they're the ones that have to go through 1,000 lifetimes. We can just do it now. This is my argument with him. And this is good fun. I mean, we like each other. We're not seriously arguing. But you get the point that this amata, this thing that we're trying to attain to, must already be with you. And this is what we call Buddha nature. And I actually like that concept. I like calling it something. In Theravada, we won't call it anything, because anything you call it, it's not that. But to call it something is nice. You can start to relate to the concept. You have Buddha nature within you. It's there, it's yours, it's free. You just have to find it. It's already part of your experience. So, if this enlightenment is unconditioned, it means there's nothing you can do to attain to it, right? Because you can't change your mind from this kind of mind into that kind of mind that's enlightened. Because whatever state of mind you create, that's something that's been created, it's something that's going to disappear too. Any way that you rearrange your mind or your experience or your consciousness, that's not enlightenment. And this is why many teachers who are probably enlightened can't teach. I don't know if you've seen some of these people, like Krishnamurti. It's always questionable if someone's enlightened or not, but let's just open the door to the possibility. I went to see one of these guys. His name is Papaji. And when I was entering into Ajahn Sumedho's temple, he was all the rage. And the whole bunch of novices that were going to become monks, at the time, they heard about Papaji and they said, well, he's enlightened. So they quit Amaravati and they all went over to see Papaji. I was a little dubious about this. But some people will go and sit in front of him and then bingo, they get it. They get enlightened. And my thinking was, I can either ordain as a monk and go through years of renunciation and harsh environment and one meal a day in a difficult environment in a Thai temple, or I can go and sit in front of Papaji and get bing. So I went off to India and thought I'd try. My intelligence knew that I was skeptical, shall we say. And I did. I went to see him and I sat in front of him and I didn't get any bingo, nothing happened. He was a nice old man, but he didn't have any kind of teaching. There's nothing he could teach. Because he would say there's nothing you can do to create it. Nothing you can do to get enlightened. You just are enlightened. And one person a million would just get it and become enlightened, and the rest of us would have nothing. Just go for lunch. And many of these guys are like that. They don't have any way that they can teach. Ramana Maharshi, Nisargadatta, many of these guys. Ajahn Sumedho's favorite book was Nisargadatta, I Am That. And Nisargadatta would teach in that same way, as you can't do anything. Whatever you do, that's just something that you've created. Whatever is made by the mind is more mind. Whatever is made by the ego is another ego. You're like, so what do I do then? There's nothing you can do. And then you're stuck with this catch-22. Enlightenment is unconditioned. You can't create it. It doesn't arise. It doesn't cease. We actually have room in Buddhism for enlightened people like this, who are not Buddhist, and they're called Pachyeka Buddhas. And according to the tradition, you have three kinds of Buddha, or three kinds of Arahants. One is the Anubuddha, who is a regular Arahant, who's heard a teaching, done a practice, and become enlightened. You have a Pachyeka Buddha, who has come across enlightenment by themselves, but they're unable to teach others. My speculation is, when we say they're unable to teach others, surely they can teach somebody something, right? I think we just take the principle that they don't have many millions or thousands of followers who are all becoming enlightened. But let's say they can probably teach a few people something, you know. And then you have a Sammasambuddha, and a Sammasambuddha is a perfectly enlightened being. And what that means is they've developed over lifetimes the qualities of character, of leadership, of charisma, of patience, of generosity, etc., so that when they become a Buddha, they have a huge influence and they can draw many people after them and teach many people this amata. So what we're doing then, because there's nothing that you can do to create create this amata, what do you do? And this is where a Sammasambuddha is different to anyone else that's enlightened, because they are able to point out certain qualities that you can develop that will take you in the right direction. No, you can't develop enlightenment. You can't just get enlightenment. You can't figure it out intellectually. But there are certain ways in which you can tip your experience, certain qualities that you can improve in, which will start to change your being, and these will lead you towards enlightenment. At the end of one sutta, the Buddha talks about someone who's heard about enlightenment, they've left their home and family, they've become a monk, they've practiced contentment with little, and living on the four requisites. Then they go to, they practice mind guarding the sense doors, they practice Satisampajanya, or mindfulness. Then they practice overcoming the hindrances. Then they practice psychic powers. Then they practice seeing previous lifetimes and heavens and hells. And then finally, the end of the asava, which means you attain to enlightenment, but you're not yet enlightened. Wow. And at the end of all that, he said, such a person is not enlightened, but they're on their way. It's quite a tall order. That's a long list of stuff that you've got to do, and you're still not enlightened. But this is the Chulahati Pamo Pada Sutta, if you're interested. So there are these certain qualities that you can develop, and patience is worth developing. In fact, all good qualities are worth developing. Yesterday I talked to the youth group here, and I asked them to name good qualities, and they said, generosity, patience, kindliness, compassion. And then one of them, which I think I would only have heard in Singapore, listed as a good quality, this girl said, discipline. That wouldn't have come from a Thai audience, I can tell you. And on the other hand, the negative qualities. So like all the traditions, spiritual traditions, can agree on this. We want to set out ways in which we can try and develop wholesome qualities and try to reduce unwholesome qualities. It's up to you to decide what is wholesome and unwholesome. In Buddhism, one of these wholesome qualities is mindfulness, this quality of simply awareness. And we pick this out as something that's really important. Now, mindfulness is simply just awareness. It's not another practice like other practices. So many spiritual traditions have a wide range of practices, and it gets a little confusing about what practices we should develop and what we shouldn't develop. This Tibetan monk that I was arguing with, he told me I had to recite this particular mantra 100,000 times, and I had to buy a little counter, and every time I recited it, I had to click it so I could keep track of how many times I'd recited it. I did pretty well. I got up to like 60,000 before I had enough of that. Does that help, reciting a mantra that much? On the one hand, any practice you undertake, if it's in the name of or in the cause of enlightenment, it's going to help. It's going to take you in that direction. Anything you do deliberately because you are generating an awareness of something called enlightenment, that's going to take you in the right direction. But at the end of all of this, what you really can do is you can recite the mantra better. Right? Is that really a useful goal? So there's a lot of, I call the wacky races of spirituality, a lot of different practices. I don't know if you've seen these nuns in Nepal, I think it is, and they live high up in a very damp mountain. And so when they wash their robes, they can't dry their robes because the air's so wet. So what they do is they put their robes on wet. They imagine in their mind a glowing ember of charcoal or coal in the center of their body and generate this heat inside their body. And they walk around the temple generating this heat so that all the water comes out of their robes. And these steaming monks and nuns walk around the temple. This is actually true. And do you know how I know it's true? There's one proof positive anyway that you can tell whether something's actually genuinely true or not true. It's on YouTube. I think you need YouTube and a Wikipedia entry, and then it's definitely going to be true. And that's quite impressive. You know, if I was to wear my robes wet, I would get a cold. And so it's quite an impressive kind of practice. But does that help? How does that get you to this unconditioned that we're aiming for? It's just changing the states around a little bit, the state of your mind and the state of your body into a new state of mind and a new state of body. But that's not enlightenment either. One of these very interesting practices. This monk, actually, I was telling you about this Tibetan monk, he's quite playful. And you never quite know what he's going to come out with next. It's kind of nice listening to him, because he comes out with all kinds of wacky stuff. And at one point, he was talking about visualizing a rainbow Buddha. But he had a bit of an accent, and I swear he said a Rambo Buddha. And I had this picture of Rambo, and he's gone like sitting in a lotus posture like this. And I wasn't the only one. I looked around the audience, and some of them were going, like, Rambo Buddha? like this? And they said, yes, emanating this beautiful, multicolored Rambo out. And we're like, ah, rainbow. But it wouldn't surprise me if he actually was talking about Rambo Buddha. He's that kind of guy. Very many of these wild and wacky practices. One of my teachers that I work with quite closely, when we do the walking meditation, we walk forwards and then we walk backwards. And so we do backwards walking meditation. It's not that walking backwards will help you and walking forwards won't. It's something that you do in the name of enlightenment to try and cultivate this quality of mindfulness. Right? When I did the Mahasi Sayadaw system in my university, and I do my own system of walking. Maybe I'll teach you it one day. But in the Mahasi Sayadaw, you have to do this six-stage movement of the foot. If you haven't done it, basically you do walking meditation, and you watch the foot lifting the heel, lifting the foot, moving, placing, resting, etc. Six stages. And I don't do it that way. I tend to be more in my head than I am with my feet. So my feet were going smoothly, and this monk comes over. No, 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 you're not doing it right. And he said, you must do six individual movements. And so I said, okay, okay. And then I started to do it his way, waited till he turned around, and went straight back to exactly the way I like to do it. And then he comes over. No, 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 you... And then he said, does anyone here, because I can speak Thai, he's talking in Thai, he said, does anyone speak English so you can explain to him in English, because he doesn't understand. And I said, I do understand, I just don't agree. Moving the foot in six stages, is this, think about it this way, if you move your foot in six stages, you'll get enlightened. But if you move your foot in five stages, never get enlightened. If you think about it that way, you know, it becomes nonsense, right? It's not whether you move the foot in six stages or not. It's not whether you recite this mantra or you recite that mantra, or you make a visualization of a rainbow Buddha or a Rambo Buddha. That's not the difference of what's going to get you enlightened or not. So the key aspect, certainly when we're doing sitting meditation or walking meditation, is we're trying to develop this quality of mindfulness. Now, mindfulness is the awareness of yourself, and most of the time you're not aware of yourself. You're not aware of what you're doing. Most of the time you're lost or you're caught up in your activity. So the first step of mindfulness when it's taught is be aware of what you're doing. But even this isn't mindfulness either, because many people are aware of what they're doing, but they're not being mindful. We had in my temple one time, I went visiting Bangkok, so it wasn't my temple. I was staying in someone else's temple, and I didn't want to go through the head office, and you have to sign your name and show your certificates, and you have to go down and do all these ceremonies. I just wanted to hole up in the room for a couple of days and do my visa stuff and get home. So there was a dekwat, like a kid, in the room, and he's playing a computer game. And I went in and said, can you go and get me some fried rice for my lunch? Because I'm not going to go down to the main sala. And now this kid was playing the computer game, right? Like this. His tongue was out the side of his mouth. He's staring at the computer screen. And I said, it's 11 o'clock. Can you go and get me my fried rice? And he literally went like this. Yeah, 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 yeah. 11:15, I come back, he's still there. I said, how about my lunch? He's, yeah, 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 yeah. How about 11:45, I come in, still he's on the machine. So I turn the monitor off, and he goes, like this. What? I said, go and get me my lunch. And it, aw. And then he goes off. When he comes back with my lunch, I'm on the computer like this. Now, is that kid aware of what he's doing or not? Yes? No? Yes? Yes? Some people, not sure. No? A tricky question. Is he aware of what he's doing or not? If, on the one hand, he must be keenly aware of what he's doing, right? He's concentrated, he's fixated, he's shooting zombies and doing things. I think it was Quake, if you're interested, which game it was. I'm suddenly a bit embarrassed that I know that, but so he's certainly concentrated, he knows what he's doing. Okay, let me change the question a bit. Is he being mindful while he's doing it? Does anyone think he was being mindful when he's doing it? Does anyone think that the Buddha in the suttas, he says, monks, there are these roots of trees, there are these caves and mountains. Go forth, strive and meditate for enlightenment. And do you think in the modern era he would say, monks, there are these computer games. Go forth and be mindful for enlightenment. So obviously, now the kid's not being mindful. Now he's aware of what he's doing. Clearly, sharply, thoroughly. But he's not aware that he's doing it because his mind is caught up in what he's doing, right? His mind is completely lost and caught up in what he's doing. He's fixated. All of his attention is outside of himself, so he has no home awareness. He has no awareness of himself engaged in this activity. He only has awareness of this activity, this computer screen. In fact, basically his awareness doesn't vary from that square box. You know, you have to like kick him and poke him to make him become aware of anything else in the room. So the first step of mindfulness, usually we say, try to be aware of what you're doing. If you're walking down the street, be aware that you're walking down the street. If you are washing the dishes, be aware that you're washing the dishes. But even that, as a practice, as you keep doing it, as you keep trying to be aware in the present moment, even that practice, you're still getting lost or caught up in what you're doing. It's simply that you're more in the present moment than any other time. So if you're walking down the street, you can be lost in thought about something, or you can be concentrating on walking down the street, but you're still fixing the mind on something. So the quality of mindfulness is even independent to that. So I describe it as the feeling of the sense of knowing what you're doing. So if you're thinking, most people are just thinking. But if you're mindful, you know that you are thinking. If you're desiring something, most people just know the thing that they desire. With mindfulness, you know that you are desiring. If you're angry, you're not just angry because of this person who's really annoying. You are aware that you are angry. If you are peaceful, you're aware that you are peaceful, not just getting caught up in peace. So mindfulness gets paired with every state of mind. We did meditation last night with a friend of mine, and he said halfway through the meditation was good, but the rest of the time there was just all these thoughts. And he missed the fact that he was mindful of those thoughts. Normally you're not. Normally all of these thoughts in your mind, you're just caught in it, and you think it's you, you think it's me. Now he's doing it in mindfulness, now he's doing the meditation, he sees that there are all these thoughts. That's a fundamentally different way of experiencing your mind. Normally you experience the mind as this is me, thinking stuff. When you're meditating, you see this is me, and this is my mind annoying me with all these thoughts. He was being mindful. The trick was, what he was mindful of wasn't pleasant. So he said it's not a good meditation. A good meditation is irrelevant whether what is happening is pleasant or unpleasant. You should bring awareness or mindfulness to both. Now this quality of awareness then, if we practice it, this is why we sit down and we deliberately practice. When the mind goes out to a sound, we notice hearing and we bring the mind back. When the mind goes out to something that you can see, either literally or in the imagination, you note seeing and you bring the attention back. When the mind goes to thinking, you just note thinking and you bring the attention back. What's important is being able to, one, when a distraction arises, it has an attraction to pull your attention away into it. Right? So you're sitting here now wondering what's for lunch. And you are now that I've mentioned it. So when the idea of what you're going to eat for lunch comes up, there's an attraction for you to think about that, right? You think about something your husband or your wife or your parents said to you yesterday that you dislike. They blamed you for something that you didn't do. I'll tell you a story about that. Then what happens is an attraction to think about that topic. Think about something now that your parents, your husband, your wife said to you yesterday that you really like. There's an attraction to think about that. this is attachment, upadana. So when we say attachment causes suffering, we're not talking about, as a student, you're attached to passing your exams. If you're a Buddhist, therefore, I don't have to pass my exams. You know, that's wrong. If I'm a parent, I'm attached to my children. You know, if I'm a child, I'm attached to my parent. If I have a job, I have to be attached to succeeding in my job. So some people kind of blame Buddhists to say, well, attachment causes suffering. That's not true. All the beautiful things in my life come from being attached to things. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is when you're doing this mind, when you're being mindful and you feel the pull of something trying to draw your attention into it. So can be a sound, can be a thought, can be a taste, or the imagination of something to taste. Marmite, I mean, what can be possibly more attractive in this world to think about than Marmite on toast? Huh? Vegemite. either or, I'll give you either or. So that you're attracted to think about it, that's attachment. Feeling in the body, pain in the knee, a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, there's a draw to attach into that. When you're doing the meditation, anything that attracts your attention, you note it, you let it go, and you come back. You're training yourself in non-attachment. The more you train yourself in non-attachment, the more you get this sense of just being. And you have this sense of just being while you're doing all the other things. So even while I'm sitting up here doing talk, when I first gave Dhamma talks, you know, there's a survey of what people are afraid of. And do you know what was the top of the list of what people were afraid of? Huh? Spiders. No, that was quite far down. My list is way up there. But generally, the fear of death was number two. The number one fear, public speaking. That means people would rather die than get up in front of a crowd. The first Dhamma talk I ever gave, there's a friend of mine, and he's senior to me, and he would always push people, mainly by laughing at them. He'd laugh at you until you did it. And he told me that I had to do a Dhamma talk. And so he just laughed at me for avoiding it and called me all kinds of names. And eventually I conceded and said I would do it. And I'd do it in his temple on Songkran Day, Water Festival Day. What he didn't tell me was there would be round about 6,000 people listening. And the way they do it in Thailand, they have these towers that are about 8 foot up in the air, and you go and sit in this tower, and it's got a beautiful roof, and it's supposed to be like a heavenly realm. But these things were built for Thai size, right? So you had this little tiny ladder to go up, and when you were inside it, it was built for like small Thai people and not long English people. So my knees were sticking out of the heavenly gates, and my... My head was ducking under the heavenly roof like this, looking at 6,000 people trying to do a Dhamma talk. And boy, I was shaking. And one of the ways that we train ourselves to do the public speaking is you leave one side of you doing the public talk, but the rest of you is with this mindfulness, this awareness. And that's my home now. And I know that all of this and the Dhamma talk will end. But this awareness, this mindfulness will never end. This is always there. Even when you're in hospital, I think that's my number two after spiders of the big fears, being in hospital. Even then, even getting terrible diagnoses of illnesses and things like this, that mindfulness is still there. It's always there. It's always ticking along. It's always with you. If you have this, then you've cultivated this sense of being, you can see things differently. And this is why in Buddhism we don't say you should do this and you shouldn't do that. We say cultivate mindfulness. Because however you want to change, that's just more of your ego. You decide, I'm like this, but I want to be like that. That's just more ego, and all you're going to do is create another ego. It may be a better ego, but it's all ego stuff. How are you going to change in a way that you don't understand? How are you going to change to attain to something that you've never tasted? You need a special tool to do that. So the mindfulness then will, hopefully, should start exposing yourself to yourself. It exposes anger as something that's unpleasant. When you see it as unpleasant, naturally you start to unwind or unravel from it. And many people come and they say, how do I let go of anger? You just need to be mindful of it. We can give tips and tricks, but really if you're just mindful of it, you get sick of it. The Buddha said unwholesome qualities are like this. Imagine a young man or a young woman who's very proud of their appearance, spends a lot of time grooming and working on their appearance. Imagine with that person if you were to drape a dead dog over their shoulders. Nice graphic metaphors, I like this. What would that young man or that woman do? They would immediately cast that dead dog away from their shoulders. In the same way, when you start to see negative qualities and you see them with mindfulness, you naturally just want to throw them off. You naturally start to change in a way that you couldn't have changed yourself. You can't make a determination, I'm just going to be good and I'm never going to be angry. But when you see negative qualities, you naturally want to throw them off because you've seen it with mindfulness. This is the miracle of mindfulness. This is why we develop this one particular quality over and above other qualities, because this one quality will lead into all of the other qualities. The way it works, mindfulness, then, you have there's a famous teacher, Ajahn Brahmot, in Thailand. If there are any arahant, he's probably a good candidate. He's quite special, quite amazing. Very simple. And I was listening to him teaching one day, and this woman came and asked him this question, a very typical answer of his, and he said, "It's not your responsibility to fix this problem in yourself or in your family." He said, "It's your responsibility to be mindful. Mindfulness will arouse wisdom, and it's wisdom's job to solve your problems for you." He's saying you don't need to solve the problems, you leave wisdom to solve the problems. Wisdom, you have three kinds, Chintamaya Banya, which is wisdom that comes from learning. So you can read books, you can listen to talks, you can get wisdom from wise people. Sutamaya Banya, which is wisdom that comes from figuring stuff out. You can figure out for yourself what is good, what is bad. You've got to be careful with this because the mind will trick you into figuring things out that you want and not that you don't want. So you can be a little bit careful of that. And the last one is Pavanamaya Panya, which means the wisdom that comes from practice, the wisdom that comes from actually developing this quality of mindfulness. Then you start to realize you can let go, you can change, you can see things in a new way, you can act and react in an appropriate manner. Now, I said to you a little earlier that I had a story about that, and I said I was going to tell you. Just to finish off with, because we're close to the end. There's a wartime recipe in England. And what they would do is, if you have any stale bread, because of the rations, you couldn't let anything go to waste. So stale bread, you would soak it, you'd mash it up with sugar and raisins and butter, you'd squeeze all the water out of it, put it in a baking dish and put it in the oven and bake it. And what you get is something like the consistency of window putty or plasticine. It's like heavy, stodgy, gooey, very tasty. Kind of like mass. And you can't eat too much of this stuff. So my mother had made one of these, unbeknown to me. Honestly, I didn't know. Now I come home one day, just ordinary day, come home whistling away, open the door, I come into my kitchen, and my mother is like, you, I'm fed up of you, I'm sick of you, I want you out of my house. You're so bad, you're a bad son, you're irresponsible, you're selfish. I'm like, what have I done? You know very well what you've done. And I'm going through like the many things that I've done. I'm wondering which one that she's found out about. was like, what have I done? And she said, you ate the bread pudding. I'm like, that's not even on my list. I said I didn't know there was a bread pudding. She said, you liar, you've eaten it. I'm sick of it. I spent half the day making this and you just ate it. And I'm like, hang on a minute, when you make one of these, it's like a tray that big. I'm like, no human being could possibly eat a whole bread pudding. She said, you could. And so we're arguing away, and I'm just like, what can I do? And at that time, moment, my father comes in. As most men, he's completely oblivious of what's going on. He comes in, he goes over to the oven, opens up the oven, he pulls out the bread pudding, which has a little corner missing. He cuts himself a second piece. Then he puts it back in the oven. My mother's face is like, why have you put it in the oven? And my father's like, huh? He said, there were flies buzzing around because my mother would leave it out to cool, right? So it should be exposed. And he'd seen some flies buzzing around, so he put it in the oven to stop the flies getting. So I just put it in the oven to get the fly. Don't you put my things in the oven. You leave them where I put them. And my father was, he was out like a shot. He was gone. Now, I am leaning on the kitchen counter with this big smirk across my face. Okay. I'm waiting for my apology. So I want to do a quick survey of the men in the room. What do you think my mother's response was? Was my mother's response, sorry for blaming you, it wasn't your fault? Was my mother's response to just ignore me? Or was she still angry at me? Raise your hand if you think she apologized. Raise your hand if you think she just ignored me. Just the men. I just want the men to answer the question. Just the men. Raise your hand if you think she was still angry at me. Basically all the men who are married. Okay, so the ladies, do you think that how many of you think my mother apologized? How many of you think she just ignored me? How many of you think she was still mad at me? She was still mad at me. She said, I was waiting for my apology, and she said, she was like, this is what she said, I'm not joking, this is honestly what she said. She said she was mad at me because, she said, you would have eaten it if you'd known it was there. What can I do? So, if you're practicing mindfulness, you see yourself getting mad, and you see yourself getting attached to this feeling of being mad and being angry. If you're really being mindful, you're starting to become honest, and you're seeing these kind of emotions taking hold of you, and you're getting absorbed in the emotions. So then you can arouse wisdom, and you can say, okay, I was wrong, I made a mistake. It's not that difficult. Sometimes when you make an idiot of yourself, I could tell you more stories, but there's no more time. I've made an idiot of myself on a number of occasions, and it's like you try to argue, you try to save your reputation, and actually you're better going, I made an idiot of myself, just own it, and then it's not a problem anymore. If you're practicing mindfulness, you start to see all of these times when you're just so caught up in your moods, you're so caught up in the emotion, you're so caught up in the feeling of the situation that you really can't see what the appropriate action is. So, it was a kind of halfway through, but we're out of time. So, I'm going to stop there. Hopefully, talking about mindfulness has brought up this concept, brought up this idea, and has reminded you and reminded myself that this is the quality that we're trying to develop. when we try to develop mindfulness, the miracle of mindfulness is that when we're mindful, all the other qualities start to come into place. Because we can see what is the appropriate action, we can see what is the appropriate response, we can see what is the appropriate aspirations that we should be developing. So, I'm going to stop there. We've got 5 minutes just in case anybody has a particular question or comment or reaction.
Shall we say three sadhus?